Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination, and you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, folks. My name is Lynn, and as always, I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone. I'm not alone, as usual. I'm joined by my wonderful co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Robert, and Dave. Hello, guys. Nice to have you here.
Hello.
Hi, Lynn.
Hiya.
Hi, Lynn.
Who said hi, Lynn? Was that you, Robert?
Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. Well, it's just so wonderful to hear all of you.
Hello, my name is Robert, and I am a Twilight Zone junkie. And everyone says, say hi, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
Like one of those professional meetings or something you go to. And,
yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous, yes. Hi, my name is Ben. And I've been
after
watching Twilight
this,
Zone for, I've been watching
wouldn't
Twilight
blame
Zone
it.
For 40
yeah.
years. Hello. No, it's 8 days until Christmas. We were just talking about that. So soon another one will have come and gone. Dave has done no shopping yet, but he's one of these last-minute people.
Yes, he did. Dave shopped for himself,
okay, he's
weeping what he bought. So well done, Dave.
That's right. He's enjoying his wonderful wine. And my kind of guy, get that wine. But, I hope everyone else is just about finished with the preparations. I don't want anybody to have a stressful holiday. I finished all my shopping and wrapping some time ago, and now the only thing left for me to prepare is my Christmas dinner. Bought a big old ham for me and Bobby yesterday, along with the rest of the fixings I'm preparing.
To take a picture of that, Lynn, and send it to us so we can all drool over the food that you prepared that we cannot partake of.
Yeah, so, Lynn... Lynn, does that mean you're living with two old hams at the moment?
At the moment, yes. There you go, Bobby. He knows you.
He knows me so well.
My ham, my homemade macaroni and cheese, my coleslaw, my green bean casserole, and I'm making a lemon meringue pie, and oh my God.
Now, I got
wonderful.
A question I got to ask, because what started the tradition of the green bean casserole? Why it...
Campbell's Green Bean Casserole. Make some holiday magic.
Every Thanksgiving Campbell's and Christmas soup. Is a green bean casserole.
Because
Campbell's
I like it.
Natural. Oh.
No, Campbell's soup started that. And, however, I always made it the traditional Campbell's soup way. This year I found this incredible recipe on the internet. It's made by some chef from France. I forget his name. But he makes a green bean casserole totally different. It's not with those dry French fried onions or anything. He caramelizes his onions. He adds Swiss cheese. He makes a white sauce, and he pours it, and it's supposed to be outstanding. So I'm going to make it that way this year. You know, I'm not making it with those dried onions and all, like, and the mushroom soup and all that. No, mine's going to be totally different this year.
I hate to change the subject, but can we start this episode? I can't wait to start talking. Okay.
Maybe that's why we changed this subject.
I love this episode, so let's go.
Yeah, that's why we changed the subject, so we're not talking about
This is
the
Twilight Cooking
episode.
Show. Next, we're going to talk about the disappearing pineapple cake.
Right.
Today's episode is called The Arrival.
And now, Mr. Serling.
This object, should any of you have lived underground for the better parts of your lives and never had occasion to look toward the sky, is an airplane. Its official designation, a DC-3. We offer this rather honest comment because this particular airplane, the one you're looking at, is a freak. Now, most airplanes take off and land as per schedule. On rare occasions, they crash. But all airplanes can be counted on doing one or the other. Now, yesterday morning, this particular airplane ceased to be just a commercial carrier. As of its arrival, it became an enigma. A 7-ton puzzle made out of aluminum, steel, wire, and a few thousand other component parts, none of which add up to the right thing. In just a moment, we're going to show you the tail end of its history. We're going to give you 90% of the jigsaw pieces, and you and Mr. Sheckley here of the Federal Aviation Agency will assume the problem of putting them together, along with finding the missing pieces. This we offer as an evening's hobby, a little extracurricular diversion, which is really the national pastime in the Twilight Zone.
And the episode begins when Flight 107 out of Buffalo lands and taxis to a perfect stop with no passengers, no luggage, no crew, no pilot. Grant Sheckley is an FAA with a spotless record of no unsolved incidents in 22 years. He interrogates everyone involved with the flight and investigates the plane, two men named Malloy and Banks, who are airline executives. Sheckley says the names on the passenger manifest seem familiar, and he can't understand why none of their friends or relatives have made an inquiry into their whereabouts. Even more baffling is that each man sees a different seat color when he looks inside the plane and also sees a different serial number on the side of the plane. Sheckley proclaims that the plane is not really there, that it's merely an illusion. So in order to prove his theory, he tells one of the men to start the plane, and he will then walk through the propeller. He says if he's wrong, he wants the men to inform his wife of his death. If he's right, the plane will be just what he said, an illusion. So he does walk through the propeller, which causes the plane to immediately disappear. But then the other men, Malloy, Bankston, and the others, also disappear. Sheckley then finds Bankston and Malloy in one of the airport offices and demands to know what's going on. So neither man knows what he's talking about. But Bankston, who, you know, he knows who Sheckley is, and he tells Sheckley that Flight 107 arrived on time and everyone was on board, but he remembers that another Flight 107 did disappear about 17 years ago. It was lost in a fog, and it was never found. He also remembered that it was the only incident that Sheckley was never able to solve. So the case has been haunting Sheckley all these years, and it finally drove him over the edge, and Sheckley runs back into the hangar screaming like a madman. I'm glad I know that much, much better episodes will be following this mess of a story. Season 3, now that everyone knows Season 3 started out with a pretty good episode. And then we get this. So I can honestly say that I would not have blamed critics at that time for wondering if The Twilight Zone was finally losing its steam and creative originality after seeing The Arrival. Because we all know, I think, Robert, you know this, Dave, you know this, Rod Serling, you like to use certain plot lines over and over with various changes and twists, but this one was just awful. I mean, once again, he uses the storyline of an aircraft in trouble, or more specifically, an aircraft that's only there in someone else's mind, which reminds me of King 9 Will Not Return from Season 2, about a pilot who spends the whole terrible episode talking to himself around a plane that's not really there and seeing hallucinations of a dead crew.
We have Flight 33, or we have the last flight.
Right.
So, yeah, there's been.
Right.
Oh,
right.
That.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Flight 33. Yeah, because in Season 1 we have, and when the sky was open. Now, that's about three astronauts who disappeared one by one in the thin air, along with the rocket ship, as if they never existed. No one can explain that. And well, I didn't like that episode either. And, of course, yeah, The Odyssey of Flight 33, that's about a plane in trouble that may or may not ever be seen again. But that was a very good story. That one I actually liked. That got excellent ratings. But I have to say, The Arrival is almost, not quite, but almost as bad as King 9 Will Not Return. I found it boring, ridiculous, and totally devoid of any thrill at all. Now, Harold J. Stone, he plays Grant Sheckley, an investigator for the FAA, and he prides himself on never failing to solve a case in all his 20 years on the job, except for this one. Well, this is the case that ruins his spotless record and has haunted him ever since, so it drives him over the edge. Okay, we see that, you know, and it becomes obvious by the end of the episode that Sheckley's been reliving this case in his mind for, what, 20 years, 20, 22 years, and he can't let it go. So he let it gnaw at him to the point of literally making him crazy. Now, I would be willing to bet that this wasn't the first time Sheckley has hallucinated about the plane and his investigation of it, but this may not have been the worst incident in the 18 years after the disappearance of Flight 107. It just may have been this breaking point into insanity. For instance, the part that drove me nuts was him walking into the propellers. I mean, he very easily could have taken any object and held it out until the propellers hit it. Take a board, you know, throw a metal object into it. Throw one of the other guys into it. I mean, you know, he could have thrown anything into those propellers. And only a crazy person would risk walking into an airplane's propellers and becoming mincemeat right in front of everyone standing there. What good would that do anyone?
That was the point I brought up, too, that it was kind of stupid on his part to do something like that. But maybe his illusion was just so much to where if he did, and I didn't think of this at the time I did my review, that maybe if he did throw something through the propeller, it may have hit something, because if everybody else was an illusion, maybe what he throws through the propeller could be an illusion as well, thereby giving him a second thought about if he should put his hand through
that's
or not.
Right. Yeah, that is true. That is very true. But, well, he also tells them to inform his wife if his stupid stunt proves fatal. Okay, no problem, but it sure won't be easy explaining to his poor wife how her idiot husband died, you know? Yeah, well,
imaginary
I'm sorry to
inform
too. You. Yeah, exactly.
Call my imaginary life on imaginary phone.
I'm sorry to inform you, Mrs. Imaginary Sheckley, but your idiot husband walked through some airplane propellers and he's now strewn all over the hangar somewhere. Oh, my God, he's mincemeat. Well, luckily, the whole thing was all in Sheckley's mind, but he was rapidly losing his mind. So, overall, to me, this was a lackluster episode, a dull and uninspired ending. Now, Harold J. Stone, I think he's a very good actor. I've seen him in so many things over the years, and I like the guy. You know, I think he had a great career appearing in movies and numerous TV shows, I guess from the 50s to the 80s. I forget when he died, but I think it was sometime in the late 80s. But, you know, I suppose every actor has to endure a share of dud roles, and this was one of Harold's. Fortunately, the third season of The Twilight Zone provided us with some pretty good episodes, including the one that follows this. So the critics could breathe a sigh of relief that this wonderful series hadn't lost all of its magic yet. But my rating for this one is a one for poor, and I am sorry, I did not realize that people were telling me that there was an echo in the beginning. Once again, that's happened before. I don't know why that happens in the beginning and then it goes away. So I don't
sometimes
know. I don't
feedback.
Think
I think once you situated yourself, it worked itself out. So
yeah, I don't know if you can do anything about that, Robert. It's probably not.
Nah,
but
go on.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll just have to live with that. Sorry, Dave, I didn't notice that you weren't saying that. I was kind of like looking out the window as I was talking. But anyway.
That's how
okay,
interested
well,
she's in with this story, Dave. Have to look out the
yeah,
window.
Yeah, I was like looking out the window as I was talking. I didn't even notice that you guys were saying that, so I'm sorry. But anyway, I'm going to turn this over to you, Robert. What are your wonderful thoughts on this?
Well, I wish Mr. Horse was here to help me out on this, but he's not, so we know what he would say.
Didn't like
it.
Nope, sir, didn't like it, didn't like it at all.
No, sir, I didn't like it.
Oh, yes, what... You know, let me start out with this, Amy, too. What a wonderful story. And, of course, I give it a classic the last time I reviewed it. And to come back to something like this, it's almost like a brilliant idea, then we're falling back on stuff from the past. And as always, I've said season 3 is one of my favorite, which it still is, but it also has its dogs as well as its brilliance. And, unfortunately, this felt like, and I think in one of the other reviews, that I mentioned that it felt like a season 1 or season 2 story. I don't know how far when they write scripts that they go back with scripts that maybe some of the ones that they may have done in season 3 could have been leftovers from season 2 that they didn't use and decided to use it as a filler. Or maybe one of the things, and Dave, you could probably confer with me on this about Terry Nation. Now, if people don't know who Terry Nation is, he's the creator of Daleks. Also, he's done Blake 7, some other television shows and stuff. One of the things that is talked about among the Doctor Who community is how Terry Nation would take a script and rewrite it to be used again, and that's been brought up before with his creation, how he would take a story and just rewrite the story and just change the title of it, and people there, the production company, you know, people of Doctor Who and stuff caught on to that, to where they kind of talked to him about coming up with something a little more different instead of taking the same story and reworking it three times. You remember about that, Dave?
Yeah, I think this happens in the entertainment industry more than we think. Either reuse or reworking of scripts, recycling ideas. It happens an awful lot. And I believe this episode was originally going to be part of Series 2. Whether it just didn't come up to muster, or whether the money to film it wasn't there, they couldn't hire the plane or whatever it was. So
or maybe Rod decided he wanted a vacation, who knows.
And sometimes, again, it may well have felt as though, because it was, as you say, or as Lynn said, another program with a plane in it, he felt as though they'd already covered that a couple of times in Series 2. And so he thought, so he better leave it over till this Series 3.
You know, Felix here is even saying, Felix just typed in here, been there, seen it before, much better done. And yeah, he's right. I mean, it's how many times can you do the same storyline before it gets old and boring?
Yeah, that's why I brought up the Terry Nation situation, because that kind of the one thing that was prevalent when we talk about Doctor Who during the John Pertwee era there, about him, you know, reusing, to finally where, you know, people spoke up and said, hey, Terry, how about giving us something a little bit different? And then that's where we get the genesis of the Daleks during Tom Baker era, which was an origin story, which was pretty nice and a little bit different. But and so with this episode, we kind of get the same compared, you know, like Lynn brought up, and we talked about the different airplane episodes. My only point that I brought up, and of course I kept my review very short, was the same thing that Lynn said, was about sticking a hand through the propeller. There was actually a real life incident that just happened about a woman that wasn't watching where she was going, and fell into the propeller of a plane. And I didn't hear the results of what happened to her, but you got to think how fast those propellers are going, and you got to really keep your distance because you can't see the propellers.
Oh, they're like vegetable choppers.
Yeah.
They're like vegetable choppers. I mean, they will chop you into pieces.
They're very invisible because all you hear is just the sound of it. So, yeah, you really have to be careful. This is pretty much, as I mentioned, it was a Flying Dutchman episode, a ghost ship. Simply put, it was just on his mind of the one thing that he couldn't solve. I mean, he was able to solve other situations except for this one right here. So,
do you see what Felix read here? He said if he lost a family member on the plane, he could understand his obsession, which is true. I mean, everybody likes to have a perfect record, but, you know, to obsess over it. I mean, so there's one thing you couldn't solve. I mean, get a grip.
I mean, yeah, we all love a mystery, but the thing about a mystery, sometimes it's never solved, but sometimes it can be solved depending on what the whole circumstances are. If there's enough of the pieces that's put together to solve the whole question of what happened. With Grant, nothing is solved with this. It's very much something that got on his mind. Evidently, he wasn't granted or was told by the FCC about something like this. This is probably one night at home, and he was thinking about it, and it just took over his mind to where he went to the airport and found the investigation going on. But it wasn't a current investigation. It was a past investigation. So you see how much his mind has deteriorated. To the point that, you know, he did recognize these people, but he couldn't place them during that time. And it may never be solved. The disappearance of Glenn Miller or Amelia Earhart, those ones still never been solved.
Right,
where
exactly.
Some people still have conjecture on, you know, what happened to them.
Jimmy
you know,
Hoffa.
They
Jimmy Hoffa's
another one that was never solved. Lizzie Borden is another one that, what happened to her parents? They have kind of a possibility, but that one's still a mystery as well. So, I mean, there's still mysteries out there that can't be solved, and that's why they're called mysteries. It was very disappointing to me, you know, unlike the episode 2, which I thought was brilliant and very much kind of booked in with Time Enough at Last as one of the stories I really enjoy. This one was pretty much the millennium of the Twilight Zone, and I brought up millennium, I think, with the last flight.
TUA-35 Heavy, could you give me your location?
Minneapolis, we are currently heading zero.
TUA-35, turn to heading.
My God. Jesus, down. Go down.
For Flight 35.
We are going down.
It was the end.
Do not be afraid.
Or was it?
Walk towards the light.
What unusual facts have you developed in your investigation?
This crash has been crazy from the start.
Is there anything odd?
Going backwards. I'm afraid I still don't know what you're driving at.
I'm simply looking for the inexplicable. I usually find it.
You're endangering a project that's bigger than you can imagine.
I know damn well we can't change the past.
Time travelers. They don't want to be found.
Then you are from the future.
About 1,000 years.
Sherman, send the gate.
Once in 1,000 years comes an adventure like this.
We've been expecting you.
Millennium.
Declaring an emergency, we hit another aircraft. Looks like a 10.
3 and 4 shutting down. Heading field to 3.
We are going down. Repeat. Going down.
How much of the wing is gone?
Ron, get back there. See what's at left.
Right.
Can I have some coffee, Mr. Smith?
Damn it, I'm listening.
Still going down. Is there any place to land? I'll check.
All right, Sherman, he's seen me again. I think he's interested. What next?
What now, Sherman? Think of something.
Take him to dinner. Someplace romantic.
How do I do that?
Pick him up, my dear.
How?
Drop your hanky. Wiggle your behind.
You're the woman, Louise. You figure it out. Just be subtle.
Louise is about as subtle as a lead pipe.
Thanks.
It should be appropriate to the era.
As well as stimulating to the contemporary male.
Sorry about the high heels.
Where it's a movie that had Cheryl Ladd in it and Kris Kristofferson. And Kris Kristofferson kind of plays Stone's role in this one where, you know, he's a FCC investigator too. Finding out what happened to downed airplanes. He would go through the crashed pieces of airplanes and basically what it was the people were being taken off of the planes before the planes crashed. Basically what Millennium was about. Same thing with this. Another one I brought up too is Time Flight, which is a Doctor Who story back in 1982, which was a Peter Davison. He was playing the Doctor at that time. And
Heathrow Airport!
You're right.
Heathrow, Doctor.
Ah!
They've disturbed the neuronic nucleus, but they will have paid for the incursion with their lives.
The Xerathin is very close.
No, stop! He wants this at the center of his TARDIS.
Devious to the last, Doctor.
The Xerathin contains the wisdom of the universe.
The new order of the Xerathin has begun.
Happy landings, Doctor.
Power's gone. Look at Khalid.
got to be a perfectly simple, orthodox explanation. Bioenergetic powers. Intellectual garbage.
You won't find what you're looking for.
Won't I? You come and look at this. Psychotronics, was it, Doctor? I call it electronics.
I don't understand.
No, Doctor, you never do understand. You never do.
Pretty much the disappearance of Concorde and having to go to Heathrow and track what happened to the plane to where we find out the crew's on a different planet and the master is involved and all this other stuff. So it's very much reminding of that, and also a much, much better story than this one, Stephen King's The Landoliers.
What's the weather like?
Clouds at 20,000 feet from Great Plains all the way to Boston.
From the best-selling novel by Stephen King.
Where is everybody? They've gone, they've all gone.
Is the plane in trouble, mister?
Where is everybody?
What's going on here?
Across the boundaries of time.
Mayday, mayday, this is American Pride, Flight 29, requesting emergency aid.
Place is utterly, totally deserted.
Air Force Control, this is American Pride, Flight 29. Do you read me? Over.
Beyond the gateway to another world.
We're no longer in our own time, ladies and gentlemen.
It's really wrong here.
You're all dead.
Something is waiting for you to arrive.
It's coming, don't you understand?
Something's coming towards us, rather nasty.
They are predators.
They are going to chew the eyes right out of your head.
They are relentless.
Like the leaders are coming. They're coming for you.
And they are very, very hungry.
They will eat you alive! Alive and free!
Latest from the twisted imagination of Stephen King are creatures called Langoliers, who will make their way into your home via miniseries. Their purpose? To turn an ordinary trip into a flight of terror. E.T. bravely ventured to the set in Maine and found our own twisted tour guide of sorts, star of the sci-fi thriller Bronson Pinchot. In Stephen King's The Langoliers, an unstable airline passenger, Bronson Pinchot, is tormented by the boogeymen from his childhood nightmares. He calls them the Langoliers, an army of flying furry creatures that eat everything in their path. Patricia Wettig, Kate Maberly, and Dean Stockwell co-star.
Look at that!
And on location at the Bangor, Maine International Airport, slick-haired Bronson decided he would give us a little tour. Ready for takeoff?
This is our plane.
Come on, man.
You know, I've never seen these outside of one of those little videos. Even though they'd actually be like...
Over in the crowded terminal, Bronson introduced us to Kate Maberly.
Kate, say something in your lovely English accent. Love
you.
Say hello, loves.
Hello, loves.
Bronson, he's funny. He's very strange, but I like him.
And with co-star Mark Lindsay Chapman.
This is a nice clean-cut look. I want to show you one thing. This is hair, but it doesn't move.
Bronson next turned his attention to his deep voice director, Tom Holland.
That's it. That's it. Just tell the public how you direct Kate when she's blind. You say, you're blind. You're bloody. You don't like it. You're bleeding. You try to breathe, you can't, in action.
That
sounds right.
What am I looking at? It's got a cut.
Bronson's impersonation soon caught on with his castmates.
What did you tell me at lunch?
Shut up and sit down.
Can you see him over there, look, signing autographs? Makes me want to vomit.
Bronson and director Holland said the airport crowd problem reached its peak on a very busy Saturday.
I'm going to show them where we did that scene where I was crawling bloody and seeing a vision of an angel while people, like, on both sides were going,
honey, do you have a pencil? Because that's balcony.
Yeah, that was Belkin. Incredible.
I'm telling you,
incredible.
He is Belkin.
Now stand, Creed. Stand.
We had to wrap, but Bronson was still at it. Last seen somewhere near the International Departures.
Are those your real clothes?
Yeah, with a first attachment on a second fighter wing.
Oh, really?
That one's about a group of pastors that disappeared. What was the weird thing, and also it was a mystery in a way that they had to solve, why did the people disappear, but yet their possessions were left behind on that one.
Exactly.
So clearly better ones than this turkey of a story that we got with this one.
They started out with a great episode, so it was one step forward and two steps back kind of thing, you know. Well, you start out with this great episode for season three, and then there you go with a bad one. Luckily, the next one's good.
Yeah, like I said, it's not going to be the first. It's not going to be the last. So a lot of these episodes are going to be repeated eventually. So one out of five for me on this one. So pass it over to Bobby.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
Since you're so anxious to talk about this
story. I am anxious to talk about it. Actually, I think this is an outstanding story and really highly underrated. Actually, that doesn't come from me. That's from some moron at IMDb who said that in his post.
Now, Bobby, remember that Progressive commercial where those two insurance company guys get their pants on fire? You know, liar, liar, pants on fire.
Oh, that's right. Liar, liar. Exactly. We invented that.
Over at IMDb, it gets a 7.0 out of 10. Don't ask me why. I have no idea. And this is an old story. I'm always whining about this. You've heard it before. I don't think these kind of stories are interesting because they don't involve the audience in anything. I mean, if he's obsessed over this, that's his problem. And the story's really not long enough, and there's not enough background about him or about anything that happened to really get anything out of it. So at the end of it, when you find out that it's really his own obsession in his mind, I go, yeah, that's nice, so what? It just doesn't add up to anything. And one thing I can't stand in TV episodes is when people just stand around endlessly saying the same thing over and over and over again. Now, Lynn and I watched this earlier today, and the first thing I said to her was, how many more times do we have to go through the same dialogue? In the first 15 minutes, they keep saying the same thing over and over again. And that's just a cover for time. There's really nothing to do, so it goes on and on and on. And that bores me right there. I mean, I don't care how derivative it is of anything else that was done. If it would be done well, okay. I mean, there's some things that are worth going over and over again. But this kind of story is not one of them. It's already been discussed here today, but the funniest part, the most fun part of the whole episode is where the idiot tries to prove that's a real plane by walking into it. I mean, Rod Serling wrote this, and as many people may know, his older brother, Robert J. Serling, was a famous aviation writer. And as a matter of fact, according to the internet, Rod hired him for the Odyssey of Flight 33 so that it would be realistic. And that's right. A great episode. And so it really paid off. He should have hired him for this episode that he wrote, because he might have warned him that only an a-hole would actually walk in front of a plane to try to prove that it really is there. I mean, I even turned to Lynn and I said, there's 10,000 things he could throw in front of the propellers to prove. I mean, what are you thinking? It doesn't even make any sense. So it's just incredibly boring. I don't like stories that are all talk, 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 and it goes on and on and on and on. And it's just a shame. And it surprises me, really, about Rod Serling, because for all of his brilliance and all of his genius that is undisputed, he seemed to have an inability to not see that a story is poor when he writes it. I mean, I'm not a professional writer, so I don't know how that works, but I would think if you are a professional writer, you come up with an idea, you put it on paper, and you look at it. If you're running a TV series, you can see, is this really going to be that compelling as a story on television? It either is or it isn't. And I think you can look at this and say, you know what, for some people it may be fascinating to get to the bottom of this mystery, but that's never going to translate to TV. I mean, what's going to happen? The plane's just going to sit there, and people are going to whine about whether or not it's real. Why isn't anybody on the plane? It's just there's nothing there. Now, this story was written back, I guess, in 59 or 60 or 61, whatever. And it's too bad that it wasn't written a lot later because the space shuttle program has been ended. I think it would be a more interesting story if the space shuttle came back with nobody in it. That would be an interesting story. You'd have to really wonder exactly where they went while they were out in space. Did they go to the moon or exactly what? Now, there's a story that's compelling. But just because a plane lands in nobody, I agree, if it happened in real life, it would make big headlines, and it would be something to talk about. But as a story, it really isn't anywhere. Another thing I don't like when they do things like this is that you take the audience and you set up this mysterious story. What happened? What happened to the passengers? Where are they? How can a plane land when there's nobody there to land it? And if you get involved in it for the first 5 minutes, you go, yeah, it's a good question. I really wonder. And then at the end of it, you find out that it was all a fake, that it wasn't really happening, that he was just obsessed with not being able to find the plane. I feel I've been cheated. Don't waste my time on a story like this. If it really isn't the end of it, it really isn't anything special. And that's the problem I have with it.
Don't you also think that what you said, that Rod Serling, you know, doesn't have the ability to realize that he's written a bad story, but also he doesn't have the ability to realize when he overdoes a storyline, like a plot line. He keeps doing the same type of storylines over and over again. And
But it's easy for me to say that because I'm not running a TV series. If I did, I might have a different view, and I would say, wait a minute, you sit around every day. And because back then they were doing, 30, 32 episodes a season or something?
Right.
Today they're doing 20, 22. So
the deadline was probably tough. That's probably
imagine how difficult it was back then to have to come up with at least 30 stories, 30 original stories. People have it easy today. They do about 20. There are miniseries that do 4 or 5, and it's all over with. I mean, I'd rather be a writer today because I wouldn't be facing having to go over everything. So, yeah, you guys go back. But then The Twilight Zone is a kind of series that lends itself to familiar themes. Mysterious things happening, planes show up out of nowhere, somebody shows up, is he an alien, isn't it? And it's all similar. So I can see where episodes offshoot off of that and all look similar. But Play 33 was an interesting, compelling episode, and you should have ended right there, not try to write this ridiculous story that just is plain boring. It's just boring. I gave it a 0. Because Howard J. Stone is okay. I mean, I saw him in a million things like everybody else did. He's never one of my favorite actors. He certainly was competent. But my God, they didn't give him anything to do here. It's just to just stand there and complain. Then it ends with him holding his head, and he just isn't, you know, what's he going to do? He's totally obsessed. I'll tell you what I liked about the episode. Rod Serling's opening narration, I thought it was pretty good. I thought he set it up really well. It made it interesting at the beginning when he was talking about what was going to happen here. Plane shows up out of nowhere, and there's nobody on it, and there's nobody flying it. That sounded interesting to me, and then unfortunately, it's followed by the story. If you just stop with the narration, I might have given it a higher rating, but as it is, I'm afraid it just doesn't do anything for me. The Twilight Zone, you know, we go through this all the time, and that, the funny thing about a classic TV series is that it's its own worst enemy. You have high expectations. With all the garbage that's on TV today, I have no expectations. So if anything comes on and is even mildly interesting, I go, my God, I can't believe it. But back then, you know, I mean, there was a lot of good TV around, and it's very difficult to come and make it good week after week after week. So I give it a pass. I don't get all excited when there's a bad episode because it's going to happen. I mean, we've had some bad ones. We're going to have some bad ones coming up. Like Lynn says, the next one that we're going to talk about on the radio show is one of my all-time favorites. So, you know, it's a whole different story. And it blows hot and cold. But like I said, I'm surprised that Rod Serling just, I mean, he wasn't a TV director or anything like that. It's true. But I would think he would look at it and read it and go, I don't know. It's a nice story. Maybe I'll put it in a book of short stories. But a TV story, I really don't think so. So it's just,
you know what, Bobby?
Yeah, what's that?
If they would have done the ending maybe a little bit different to whereas the plane is there, it comes back after he leaves, a light hits it, the plane disappears, and say, for example, it appears in another airport.
Okay.
And then we go through the whole process again, where maybe it's a test from the aliens, very much like, you know, Monsters of the Do on Maple Street, testing the how people are psychologically.
Maybe where is everybody?
Well, I like that idea, except we wouldn't be on here today saying, well, that looks too much like Monsters of Dill Maple Street. But, I like that idea. Any idea would have been better. Like I said, the ending, don't make me sit there even for 23 minutes and watch this and then not give me anything. I expect something. It doesn't have to be the greatest ending in the world or a big shock. But it ought to be something where I don't feel like I wasted my time. To me, it's just a colossal waste of time. But, it's like I said, it's up and down.
I agree with you about the narration.
Yeah. I thought it was one of his best narrations, ironically enough.
The thing I liked about it was, you know, his the object, should any of you have, what did he say, lived underground
yeah.
for the better part of your lives or never had occasion to look toward the sky? But he doesn't say airplane. He says aeroplane. It's not an airplane. It's an aeroplane. You can see an aeroplane.
Maybe that's, I don't, where was Rod Serling born? I don't remember. Was it New York?
He was born in New York, yeah.
Oh, because it might, that may be part of it. That may be part of it. I thought he might have been
probably
born
around
in New
where,
England.
Where the airports like Guardia and all of them are around there, maybe been
it
around airplanes or something
to
like
hear
that.
Somebody call it an aeroplane, though. Aeroplane. He's done that many times. Even when I think he talked on the Odyssey of Flight 33, he calls it an aeroplane instead of an airplane. Must be, you know, their kind of thing.
It's just one of those bad episodes. The only thing I would complain about back, I was very young when I watched it originally, but when you see those kind of episodes or you see a few of them in a row, you start to believe that the series is burned out early. It'll never last 5 years. They're just rehashing and, you know, there's nowhere to go from now on. That's a mistake with that. That's true of a lot of series. When they start doing stories like this, it's an example that they've run out of fresh ideas. You'd be making a big mistake if you tuned out of the Twilight Zone on the basis of a story like this, because there's some sensational stories still to come, so...
Rod was born on Christmas Day, 1924, in Syracuse, New York. He died June the 28th, 1975, in Rochester,
that's right.
New York. So he's been a native New Yorker.
Because I mentioned his brother. His brother, Rob J. Serling, died last year. He was 94. I mean, he lived almost twice as long as his brother. That's amazing. I mean,
probably didn't smoke as much as his brother.
Yes, that may well be it. He lived to be in his 90s, just died last year. He wrote The President's Plane Is Missing, which was a TV movie. And I read that book, and it's really a very good book. It's a very, very compelling book. So I highly recommend it if nobody's ever read it.
He was a seasoned pilot. And he wrote a lot of the dialogue for
He might have added something to this story. He certainly did to Flight 33. But for some reason, Serling decided to go it alone. I think that was a big mistake. He should stay in areas he knows better than aviation. Well, I gave it a zero. I can't get any lower than that, so I guess I'll keep it there. All right, Lynn, that's it for me.
All right. Dave. Dave, are you sipping?
Yeah, I'm just unmuting myself. Yeah, I was having a little sip. Lots to say, although I haven't recently rewatched this, so unfortunately I was unable to rewatch it earlier today. But I do remember watching it some time ago.
Yeah, you're lucky.
Quite a few little things to say. I mean... one of the things that reminded me was one of my favourite science fiction films from the mid-1950s, This Island Earth, when this scientist, Earth scientist, who's being recruited by these people who he doesn't know he has to build an interocitor and so on. And they say that what happens is that as a scientist he sends off for these parts because some of these components burn out, and so he sends for the catalogue, and this strange catalogue arrives that's not written on paper, it's written on this sort of metallic foil, and he sees all this out of this world quote-unquote components that they decide to order them, and they all come, and basically he builds what the parts make, and it's an interocitor, which is a communication machine and more, and basically it's a recruitment thing that if you've got the intelligence to build it, then you're going to be recruited. But when he accepts the thingy, he says a plane will come to the airport to pick you up. And this plane that you see flying towards where his base is, it's got this green light throbbing round it, and it lands, and he gets in, and he realizes there's no pilot, and he gets in it, and he's taken. Anyway, the film itself is called This Island Earth, but the idea of the, you know, the remote control plane or the pilotless plane, I was reminded a lot of it by this. Of course, there was the episode from the Twilight Zone from season one, episode 18, The Last Flight, where we had a First World War plane land at an airport. So there's lots of things like that that are in it. I think Bobby's right, it wasn't really a strong enough episode, and that's probably why it had actually been set aside. I think the reason why it was used, Bobby, is probably the word deadline. I think probably they didn't have another script to go and basically...
I don't envy anybody having to do that. You had to come up with over 30 stories in those days, and that is that's scary when you think about what they're doing today. They're not doing 30 stories a season, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and probably they'd already done a lot of the prep work. So basically it was a story that could get up and running in 3 days or 4 days. Now, one thing that I'm going to... I seem to be challenging Bobby. I don't, actually. It's just because I follow you, I suppose. You said, how ridiculous was that, that the man... the way he chose to prove that it wasn't a real play, it was to walk into the rotor blades.
Yeah.
This episode, right, it was directed by a man called Boris Sagal.
Yeah.
S-A-G-A-L.
Right. Yeah.
Boris Sagal died, not surprisingly. He died in May 22nd, 1981, almost exactly 20 years later. How did he die? Siegel was killed in an accident during the production of miniseries World War III.
Yeah, I remember when he was that now. Yeah, now you brought it up, yeah.
When he was partially decapitated
after
walking into the tail rotor blades of a helicopter on the parking lot.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's really true. Yeah, I remember now that you mentioned it,
I didn't know that. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So well, that's maybe the most interesting thing about the story now, that he ended up that way.
That was almost like a premonition, wasn't it?
Oh. Right.
Wow.
And one of the slightly interesting facts, of course, one of the other actors in it was Bing Russell playing George Cousins. He is the
Kurt
famous
Russell's
father.
Father, yeah.
Kurt Russell's father, indeed. But basically, that's all I've really got to add about this. And thank you to Robert for mentioning Time Flight, which I quite enjoy with the Concorde and so on. But really, my memory of the episode is not that current, as I say, because I was unable to rewatch it recently. But so I'd probably give it a 2, but that's only because I haven't got any more current memories to sort of be overcritical about it.
You know, Dave, you were mentioning early on about the this island, Earth.
Yeah.
Another very much comparison, because it was basically a test for that scientist to see what his intellectual abilities was to build the oscillator, like you said. Very similar to The Last Starfighter, where the video game was placed in a trailer park to test the abilities of the person playing the video game. And if that person got the highest score, he was inducted into... The group to where he went into outer space and fight the enemy of the world that put that video game on Earth to recruit people for their galactic fighting corps. So, yeah.
So, not really a lot to add. I'm sorry, Lynn, but I did think that was strange about fate, though, wasn't it? That the chap should die in such
yeah,
an accident.
That was like a premonition. I mean, I did not know that. I knew that Boris Sagal had directed it, but I had no idea how he died. That is really creepy, isn't it? It's kind of eerie.
Yeah.
And Twilight, a very Twilight Zone-like, yes.
Like the movie in Vic Morrow. What happened to Vic Morrow?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Vic Morrow, right?
That was a helicopter as well, yeah, in the movie.
Yeah, he died. You know what always got me about that, though? He died during the filming of that episode. And yet that episode was finished from beginning to end with him in it. I never understood quite how that worked. He died somewhere in the middle of it. I know that they film different scenes, sometimes ending scenes first and middle scenes, but that seems very weird. There was the whole episode in that movie with Vic Morrow was filmed, even though he died somewhere in the middle of it.
Well, very much Brandon Lee and The Crow, where Brandon Lee died accidentally, and they had to put him in through video to finish out
That's probably what they did.
Things were sometimes filmed out of sequence too, like you said, Lynn, as well. So
yeah, they film the endings sometimes before beginnings, but yeah, that's probably either that or they did what you just said. They put them in afterwards, because I always found that very bizarre that you're talking about this man. He died in the middle of filming this sequence for the movie, and yet the whole sequence was filmed. he was there from beginning to end. So when did he die exactly? But I don't know. I guess that's what we're talking about. Yeah, he probably was either edited in or they did the sequences in out of order. But yeah, those things happen.
One other thing I was going to mention about this Boris Segal, the director, is his most famous work probably is the 1971 film with Charlton Heston, The Omega Man, which I thought was a pretty good film.
Oh, don't mention Charlton Heston. Oh, Charlton Heston. He's a beautiful man. He's a beautiful man. Oh, God. Charlton Heston. He's a beautiful man. Oh,
God, it's really, really... Really, really sad.
Thank
he has an orgasm on the radio.
Oh, my God. You had to mention him. You had to mention Charlton Heston. He's a beautiful man. Oh,
can you have
man
orgasm,
man.
Can you have your orgasms privately, please?
Oh, all right. Well, don't mention Charlton Heston. You know how I am about Charlton Heston. Jeez. I told you guys this before about me and Charlton Heston. I'm just... He's a beautiful man. Anyway. All right, okay, well, anyway, I'll compose myself here. Yeah, Mega Man. Oh, Mega Man was, oh, that was a fabulous movie. Anyway, okay, so now that I've composed myself, yes, all right, so our next episode, okay, now our next episode would normally be taking place on December 31st, that's New Year's Eve, so we are going to take a little break. And we are going to not do an episode over the holiday weekend. Our
Technically.
Well,
I'll explain
you
want
to do like a commentary thing?
Yeah.
What's
I
that?
Think on the 31st I'll stick a commentary in there. That's, I think I will do one on The Obsolete Man and two. So two for the price of one for
awesome.
Christmas
that'd
and New
awesome.
Year's.
Oh, I would
so
love that.
So I'll air that on the 31st then.
That'd be great. We would really appreciate that. And we will be back again on Saturday, January 7th. And we'll be reviewing
Bobby,
the
did you say 14th? Are you sure the 7th? Or
No, the 7th. I don't want to be
you're
way back.
The 7th? Okay. Okay.
Yeah, is that okay, Bobby?
I've double checked it. Fine with that.
Okay, Saturday, January 7th. Well, our anniversary, our one-year anniversary is January 8th. So we weren't sure we would do it, but I said, well, there's, yeah. So I wasn't sure.
Really,
we
it feels like about 25 years. There's only one.
I know. It's more like 30.
Oh,
no, but we weren't going to do an episode that weekend, but I said, there's no reason why I can't do an episode on the 7th. So we will do our next show on Saturday, January 7th. And we'll be doing The Shelter, which I'm really looking forward to. And I know Bobby is very much looking forward to that, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. Get your stop, look, and listen ready. Get under your desks for a very exciting Twilight Zone.
Yeah, well, I have some things to say about that. All right.
Stop, drop, and cover. Well, okay.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Yes.
Oh,
I want to wish
that.
Yes, and Felix says Happy Boxer Day, too. So Happy Boxer Day to everyone out there who celebrates that. But I just want to wish everyone a very happy, a very Merry Christmas, actually. A very Merry Christmas, very Happy New Year, and just have a wonderful holiday season. And we will see you back on Saturday, January 7th. Have a great holiday, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody. Have a safe and happy holiday.
YouTube.
Thank you for listening to Talking Twilight Zone throughout the year. Season's greetings, happy holidays, and have a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. Until next time.